don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on November 26, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate joined me to talk about net neutrality, internet utility socialization, and the constitutional implications of one-person nuclear launch authority. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is my co-host, Nate. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And joining me again on the line from Idaho, as usual, is Rachel. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thanks, Bill.
So we're going to start by talking about net neutrality and just internet utility policy in general. I guess, Nate, let's start with the current net neutrality debate, kind of the timeline of what's going on with that, and then we'll get into some of the broader questions that this brings up.
Yeah, so, you know, this has been an issue over the past couple of years. Wasn't there the big sort of debate over it in 2015 as well?
Or is it... Yeah, there was that. And, you know, John Oliver did a famous segment on it that got a lot of people to write FCC comments, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it does periodically come up.
Yeah, and it looks like under FCC chairman Ajit Pai, formerly a Verizon lawyer, he is big into eliminating net neutrality, and it seems like... I believe there's going to be a vote on December 14th, and it seems like they have the votes to, you know, rule 3-2 and then eliminate net neutrality. A lot of people have been commenting. A lot of people have been, trying to make this a huge issue. I think there's been some, you know, real life protests that have been scheduled or I think have happened. But unfortunately, I'm not entirely sure any amount of commenting will actually affect this. So we could be preparing to see a serious change.
The premise of net neutrality, I guess, is basically, just to sum it up very quickly, that an internet service provider has to provide basically equal speed access to all different websites and businesses online without saying like, oh, we'll give you faster access to this one, or we'll slow down your access to that one, or, you know, you have to pay extra to get access at all to this site, however they want to do it. Like, net neutrality policy just says, like, it has to be pretty much equal for all of them, which has benefited a lot of startup companies because, you know, obviously, like, a site like Google is probably going to be fine under net neutrality for the most part, but, you know, maybe their next thing that they might want to acquire... some startup is going to have trouble getting off the ground if the policy is indeed something like you have to pay extra to get to their site, or people can only access it slowly, that kind of thing. So there's any number of ways that these internet service providers can configure it. And of course, they've been denying very strenuously that they would change their policies if this policy change were made. But of course, they wouldn't be lobbying so hard and pushing so hard to be able to do this if they weren't going to change how they did business.
Yeah, I do think it is interesting that Ajit Pai was appointed originally by Obama, and, you know, that sort of is the legacy of, okay, a lot of these Obama appointees perhaps were maybe not exactly who we wanted them to be and have some pretty serious results after, you know, Trump comes in here. And that sort of has been a goal of the type of forces that Trump represents, to, you know, just entrench the sort of corporate control over the internet. I do think it's interesting. There's been reports, as we mentioned about the comments, 98.5 of unique network neutrality comments oppose the Ajit Pai's anti-Title II plan. But then there has been some controversy over potentially fake astroturfed comments. There was a recent report by a data scientist, Jeff Cao, that used a sort of study that found that at least 1.3 million of the anti-network neutrality comments were fakes originating from a central source. Seems like they were mimicking the talking points of a large telecom corporation or lobbying group. And this is something that we've seen in a lot of issues, you know, these fake internet comments that people have, you know, often coming from sort of troll farms, bot farms. You know, obviously there's been the push to highlight the concerns of, oh, the Russian bots, Russian hackers, things like that. But this is pretty common practice, I would say. There's been people noticing the use of these internet comments from large U.S. corporations on a lot of different political type issues. So this is sort of, I think, the new reality when we're dealing with these sorts of open public internet issues. People with concern are going to actually just pay people to comment or pay programs to automate various types of comments, things like that.
Yeah, I guess the ultimate sort of culmination of all that stuff of like the AstroTurf social media campaigns by corporations to tell you about the wonders of like natural gas and various
Monsanto.
Genetic crop things or whatever, like if there's
Hillary
a controversy
Clinton for president.
There the ultimate culmination being that people are getting their names and addresses stolen by corporate interests to submit official comments in their name to the government in
right.
favor or against certain policies, because they know that most people aren't going to write a comment into the FCC, so they're never going to get caught for doing this.
Yeah, and some of these comments were of real people, but they didn't make the comments. So
right.
they're sort of able to manipulate the social media profiles and such there.
Do you see a time, like, I mean, there's not that much time left before this vote is going to happen. And these things generally split along, like, partisan lines. I think officially Ajit Pai was, like, nominated. You know, he was nominated by Obama originally, but, you know, moved up as chair by Trump. But you know, he was for one of the quote-unquote Republican positions on the FCC or something. So, like, you know, these things tend to be kind of deadlocked more or less along partisan lines, and then there's, like, you know, the whoever's in the White House tends to have the majority power on that if they're able to confirm people, which obviously they are under Republican Congress. But that tangent aside, I mean, is there a likely, like, is this going to be stopped before December 15th? It seems like probably not.
Yeah, I don't really quite see the leverage with which that can be utilized. I mean, it seems like I've seen a poll here, 60% of Americans have expressed support for the current net neutrality rules, but that's unlikely to completely change anything. I do think it's kind of interesting that sort of the internet activist community hadn't really been paying attention to this in the past couple months because they're too busy arguing about Star Wars Battlefront 2 loot boxes and that system for some reason, instead of focusing on this extremely serious issue, and now they're just sort of belatedly coming to activism on this. So it might be too late. Doesn't really seem. I'm just not sure where the leverage is, and we may have to sort of begin adjusting to a new reality here. I don't know.
I mean, yes, obviously some internet activists were paying attention to it, but
yeah.
But yeah, to your point, the let's say the faction of extremely militant online users who seem upset about various other things like gender representation in gaming and whether or not it should be all men or they shouldn't have to pay for loot boxes in Battlefront, like that segment that you would think would have gotten mad about something like this does not seem to have thought about how this might affect them and that sort of thing. And many of those sort of especially reactionary folks online don't seem to have been bothered that much by this so far because I guess they support Trump. So it's an interesting dynamic, certainly. Rachel, let's open this discussion a little bit more broadly. You were looking up stuff, focusing more on the bigger picture about the internet as kind of a utility, these private utilities, these internet service providers, I should say, and sort of the role of government in that. Versus the private sector. So where do we start on that?
So A lot of people have argued that internet should be treated like a utility. However, a lot of states have put restrictions on treating internet as a utility. Many states have kind of defined internet as categorically not a utility and won't allow counties or cities to treat it as such. An article in Ars Technica has said about 20 states have limits on public broadband, and a lot of that is due to internet service providers lobbying the governments of these states. One key state in this battle is Colorado, which their current law is municipalities have to hold a referendum before providing cable, telecommunications, or broadband service unless the community is unserved. So a lot of counties and municipalities have taken upon themselves to hold kind of preemptive referenda to opt out of this law. And I think 31 out of 64 counties in Colorado have opted out, as well as a handful of municipalities that are probably in less friendly counties have opted out locally. So a big city, Fort Collins, actually just held a referendum this November and overwhelmingly voted to opt out of this law. So I think Fort Collins and Colorado as a whole is pretty uniquely poised to kind of be a front runner in this battle for municipal broadband or local access broadband to fight against these big national companies.
Well, I guess one of the key words that you mentioned there was this issue of unserved counties. Mm-hmm. And that may be one of the reasons why Colorado has emerged as this specific battleground. There are many areas of the country that have either no high-speed internet access at all, or they have one provider. I think that's something we've talked about previously in the context of Idaho on the show. You know, various efforts by the government to promote, going back as far as the 90s, to promote internet access in rural areas have often fallen short. And so then that was why some people had suggested that maybe there should be these publicly provided options by cities or counties or whatever. But then even major cities in the United States, some of the major cities have basically one provider. That's bad in its own way, as opposed to the county that either has no providers or has one provider that basically like refuses to provide a hookup to people. I guess certain people in cities that have multiple providers and can, you know, have a real free market to choose from sometimes don't really understand the sort of concern that people have with the sort of cartel power of these utilities, or why they should be regulated as if they were public utilities, or in fact, possibly even taken over as public utilities.
Right. And even large cities have the problem with choice. So I know a lot of people have been talking about New York, which I think Time Warner and Comcast are basically your only choices. And they have both, you hear awful things about Comcast customer service. I'm sure Time Warner is just as bad. Here in my city, we have CenturyLink and we have Cable One. And those are our two competitors. So we, even relatively robust markets that are well connected, just don't have that choice. One thing that I was really struggling with is that broadband is, the definition for broadband is 25 megabytes per second download, 3 megabytes per second upload. And that is actually a pretty low bar. And they found that nearly half of 118 million U.S. households even reached that standard. So it's we're really struggling with even providing a good service where it's available.
And I think, I mean, that's the thing. If the private sector were completely covering this and providing it with no problems, I don't even think there would be really a question here. And people would just be like, fine, just, I guess, let the private sector keep doing it. But the fact is they're miserable at it. And they're very abusive in the way that many of the other private or privately operated utilities are. And then this leads to the question of, should this even be private at all? And obviously, you talked a little bit about the sort of municipal broadband controversies for direct provision there. Then there's also the bigger question about whether this should have been private in the first place, right? Because the government spent billions of dollars developing the internet. Yeah. There were certain components of what made the, you know, World Wide Web and access to it that were certainly developed privately by companies like Xerox or whatever. But in terms of the actual like underlying architecture of the internet and how to connect the computers to each other over long distances. That was funded by billions of dollars in government grants.
By Al Gore.
Not by Al Gore, but, you know, almost all Americans basically need internet at this point to do a lot of basic things. And because the government spent billions on developing the internet, should this have been private in the first place? Should we think about it not being private going forward?
I think a lot of people have stated that putting money, public funding into this is a low return on costs. But I think because it is such an essential service these days, I think the benefits of connecting everyone, no matter how rural you are or how far away from a metro center you are, I think having that access be a universal service is worth the cost that would be putting that infrastructure in place.
Yeah, and I think also we need to start talking about moving towards even faster than broadband, getting that spread to everyone, you know, the T1 connection and things like that. I mean, presumably within the next couple decades, that should be the standard. But if we can't even get rural broadband in a lot of places, that's a pretty severe limitation. I also did want to mention, I'm just seeing, as I mentioned about the protests, the Fight for the Future campaign is planning to protest various Verizon stores during the holiday shopping season. There's a planned protest here in Boston at the Verizon store on Boylston Street on December 7th, so about a week before. And there's probably a bunch of other protests planned around the country. So I think that could be valuable, just sort of getting out there and, you know, having an actual street presence. Can't just angrily post about it online. You actually sort of need to go out into the real world. So, yeah, I'm seeing that from Evan Greer, who's the director of the Fight for the Future campaign here. I think she's based in Boston. But as we've talked about this, it does need to be something that's, even if we ultimately fail, I think it needs to be at least have people out there in the streets talking about it, because otherwise it can just maybe slip under the radar a little bit, or just have people sort of hear about it and they kind of ignore it. It's like, oh, things haven't changed that much. Like maybe my internet bill went up a little bit or certain websites are a little bit slower, but some people might not realize the full implications of this. So
again, with that big picture question on the public-private role, you know, in the past I've compared a lot of the telecoms, which again, I feel have been pretty irresponsible and bad at everything. And, you know, the constantly jacking up the rates without actually delivering services, which was supposed to be like, you know, one of the criticisms of the like monopoly Bell telephone stuff that was, you know, a public-private sort of arrangement that had been made. Like, well, now we've got a system that has all these different companies and they still do a bad job and they have almost no oversight for the most part. I mean, that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but I've compared them to railroads in the 19th century, where, you know, the private companies were building out to all these different areas, but then certain areas would have like multiple redundant services, certain areas would have no service at all, certain areas would have monopoly service. But even in the areas where there would be like two rail providers, you would often get situations where they were being really abusive to their customers. The government regulation would subsequently become critical in ensuring a lot of fairness issues got resolved for consumers, although some of it was never really completely resolved at all. And then ultimately in, you know, 1971, the passenger rail actually got nationalized through the form of creating Amtrak. That's a completely government-owned rail entity. It operates, except in the Northeast Corridor, on other companies' rail, but it basically the government took over their passenger railroad services in the rest of the country, and then they have their own rail that they own in the Northeast Corridor, and that's completely controlled by the government, often micromanaged by Congress. Some people don't realize that. I think they mistakenly think that, you know, like a Greyhound bus company or something, that it's a private entity, but it is in fact a completely, you know, government entity. There are certain elements, as we've talked about before, whether we're talking railroads, whether we're talking energy utilities, you know, electricity, natural gas, things like that, where the private sector continues to operate these things, but has pretty much failed at it. And they have a natural monopoly in that it is very expensive and difficult to build a lot of these networks. I mean, like if you're putting in high-speed internet underground in a city, that requires you to have all the like relevant permits to be able to do all the underground installations and any sort of additions that you need to make to utility tunnels and things like that. So it is very similar to a lot of these other kinds of utilities like pipeline utilities and subways and things like that. That does, again, continually lead back to this question, which is, should this be in private hands at all? These companies give a lot of money to the both of the major political parties to ensure that that's not really on the table. But obviously on this show, we like to ask those questions anyway. Rachel, have you been seeing discussions of a nationalization question or socialization question, or is that restricted to the municipal level?
I did find an article on the Daily Dot that was just titled "Nationalize the Internet." So I think people are kind of floating the idea. I know they pointed out things like the healthcare system, the environment, the airline industry, education, and they've kind of shown that like deregulation and decentralization of these services have really failed on the promises of delivering good service for cheaper. So I think the internet is just another entry in that long list of things where private companies have argued that they can deliver a service with a cheap cost to the consumer, a cheap cost for infrastructure costs, and they just really haven't delivered. I know a lot of the justification for raising rates is infrastructure, but a lot of these systems have gone unupdated, unexpanded. So it just really hasn't borne out in reality.
Right. I mean, that's the thing that I keep coming back to, which is this issue of like they're charging more because they're supposedly building more infrastructure, but then it's not available even to all the customers within that company. And it's continuing to not be available in many of the rural parts of the country at all. Like I said, there have been proposals in the 90s for rural internet access. President Obama had a major initiative that was, you know, for 8 years was supposed to be doing a public-private partnership to get rural high-speed internet to places like Western Massachusetts or West Virginia or whatever. And it for the most part, never materialized. You know, at minimum, like, I think that it's kind of unlikely that there's going to be any sort of push for like an actual full-scale nationalization of any of this stuff. But at minimum, it should be possible for municipalities and counties to offer various broadband options. But again, like when we're talking about the railroad example, you know, the United States didn't nationalize all the railroads. They just nationalized part of the rail system, the passenger rail system, to make sure that primarily it was for making sure that there was access to many rural areas where the companies would have just said, oh, we're not going to offer that service anymore because it's not cost effective. And there are certain things that are always just not really going to be cost effective on a like a, you know, per person capitalist basis. But it makes sense from a government responsibility standpoint to provide that. I think at minimum, we should be talking about having really high quality, high speed internet being provided at least in areas that don't have it by the government. And I think that would also create a lot more leverage on these private companies to actually have to follow through. I mean, Nate was talking about the issue of even faster internet options than just sort of the slower broadbands that we've had in many parts of the country. There are like even I think some of our fiber optic networks in this country tend to be kind of slow compared to a lot of different countries. South Korea often being touted as an example with great internet speeds, but they are a much smaller and very densely urbanized country at this point. So that's certainly a factor as well. But like, I think it's a valid consideration that you could say like, hey, we should have a national government-run option that is providing really, really high-speed, high-quality internet access, not just to rural areas, but saying that if the private companies don't put it in certain areas of the country where they, you know, they're offering some type of broadband already, but it's slow, it's bad, it's not on up to international standards, that would be really helpful for providing leverage, kind of like the proposed public option in the health insurance exchanges, that this would create some incentive to say, like, you have to actually provide this thing or we're going to act as a direct competitor. And then in the areas where they're just not providing at all, say, well, look, you had 20 years to sort this out and you didn't do anything about it. And I think these are real and serious concerns. I mean, I know some folks in Australia always talking mockingly about one of their really right-wing senators who was going on and on about how you know, our kids in the bush can't compete in esports with the kids from other countries because of their slow rural internet speeds in Australia. And like, we're not really talking about that. Like, that's fun to joke about, but there is a serious concern about a lack of internet service in many rural areas of the United States. And this could be addressed in a concrete manner. Nate?
Yeah, I'm just reading from the Daily Dot article that Rachel mentioned. And yeah, as it talks about, 40% of rural households lack high-speed internet, according to the FCC. And just sort of making the point is, you know, are we really to believe, and I'm quoting here, are we really to believe that a child who goes without high-speed internet in their childhood can expect to compete in the global marketplace? Can a child in Appalachia on a Native American reservation or living in poverty in the inner city really be expected to achieve their potential if they don't have quality internet access? Just making the point, pretty much all jobs require working knowledge of the internet, being able to be proficient with those types of technologies. So this is really sort of a thing that would actually increase the human capital of our workforce and allow them to, as we said, better compete in a global marketplace or whatever, just be able to provide better for themselves because they actually are able to open up a web page and not have it wait like 10 minutes before it downloads a program or whatever. So,
Rachel, your closing thoughts on this topic?
I agree with what Nate just said. And for being a capitalist nation, we sure do fail at capitalism. So
we're pretty bad at it, actually. Yeah,
we're really bad at it. So I think providing that extra competition, even if it's from the public standpoint, would incentivize innovation and actually these businesses delivering on their promises.
We are going to go to a quick break, and then we're going to be talking about some nuclear weapons issues in the next segment. We'll be right back in just a moment from ArsenalForDemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line from Idaho is Rachel. So I want to talk now about the Nuclear Command Authority issue, which has been in the news, and some of the broader constitutional implications of that that I had been thinking about for a number of months even before this happened. So basically, the recent news story is that in November of 2017, there was a congressional committee hearing in the Senate on whether or not we need to change the authority rules for launching nuclear weapons, specifically basically nuclear first strikes. There hasn't been, unfortunately, there hasn't been that much debate as far as I could tell on like responding to it, unless you count basically launching because you think you're already being attacked, which I guess technically is like considered to not be a first strike. Although if the missiles haven't actually hit you yet, I would consider that to be equivalent to a first strike. But that's something that also comes up. So we'll circle back to that issue. So this was the first time that there had been a like congressional hearing on this of any kind, as far as I know, since the Nixon administration. Famously, Richard Nixon would get drunk and angry and like tell his officers to like prepare the nuclear bombers to like hit Cambodia or whatever. And, you know, that got especially bad during Watergate, and he was like drunk, and there was allegations that he hit his wife, like a Secret Service agent said that. And, you know,
I think he was ranting about the Jews as well.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on. There was the Yom Kippur War was happening. The Vietnam War was happening. There was all these like potentially escalatory crises, and he had Henry Kissinger around him, and people like would at the time were like, oh, Nixon's just playing this up to like intimidate other countries with the madman doctrine. I never really buy that still.
He was a madman.
Yeah. And I don't think if you're like blackout drunk all of the time and you have nuclear launch authority, I don't know that you're a madman like put on anymore. I think that's just you are actually out of control. The other thing, of course, Henry Kissinger, we've talked about on the show before, that subsequently under the Gerald Ford administration tried to say that we should nuke Havana in retaliation for Cuban assistance to the Angolan forces that were being opposed by the apartheid South African military in occupied Namibia that were being trained and backed by the CIA. And that's like a chain of like five removed things of our actual national interest. And yet that was supposed to be the level of like significance to conduct a first strike on Cuba. So obviously you can see why it was being reviewed back then, but for some reason they didn't really review it since then, which I think was probably a mistake. In general, I'm, you know, a denuclearization advocate, but again, let's just focus more narrowly on the issue of launch authority and sort of the implications of that. So there was a bunch of these hearings, you know, Chris Murphy, Bob Corker talking about how concerning a lot of the president's recent statements were, basically arguing that, like, all of his really aggressive comments toward North Korea were potentially going to incite a nuclear World War III. Then there was a sort of counter opinion arguing the same thing about the mere having a hearing by Rachel, your senator, your illustrious senator, James Risch. I don't know if you wanted to read his quotes on the one hand, but on the other hand, about that committee hearing.
So Senator Risch said, "There are legitimate disputes when it comes to the power of the president and the power of Congress." But also, he warned that every single word that's uttered in this hearing is going to be analyzed in Pyongyang and might lead the North Korean government to question the United States' resolve to deter the regime's nuclear aggression. A lot of talking on both sides.
Right. So he was acknowledging that there was a dispute, basically, about who has the power to regulate or change the launch authorities, but was also arguing that they shouldn't even have this hearing in public because it could potentially signal to North Korea that we weren't serious or whatever. There's also an ongoing controversy over the nuclear posture review that's happening. This often happens at the beginning, not always, but often happens at the beginning of a presidential administration. There was one in the first term of President Obama, because basically they were saying, like, we're going to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our overall global defense strategy, and therefore we can sign an agreement with Russia to reduce our nuclear stockpiles because we don't need as many nuclear weapons if it's not as big of a component of our defense strategy. The Trump administration basically going in the polar opposite direction, although Obama also kind of reversed course toward the end of his administration, doing a lot of investing in overhauling the arsenal instead of just saying, well, this old one should just be decommissioned. And the Trump administration potentially looking at $1.7 trillion in overhaul spending on the nuclear arsenal, which, I mean, that's over 30 years. So that is spread out somewhat. But again, think about all the things that they say for $1.7 trillion that we cannot have in terms of social programs and things like that. The other thing to, like, continually emphasize and underscore here, though, is that it does not actually require that many nuclear weapons to even have a nuclear deterrent. So even if you accept the premise that the U.S. has to have these nuclear weapons to be able to deter anybody else. So say you take first strike off the table completely and we just need it for, you know, retaliation or self-defense or whatever, or just deterring a first strike. You don't actually need that many nuclear weapons to do that. The U.S. has, like, well in excess of, you know, world-ending capacity of nuclear weapons. You obviously don't need that level. But the other thing, of course, is that, like, nuclear submarines, part of the whole reason that the not just nuclear-powered submarines, but actual nuclear-armed submarines, I should say. The whole, like, reason for doing that was so that you could basically respond after getting hit by a first strike, and that's the deterrent, right? They know that they can't possibly hit every target and prevent the United States from responding, so you have a submarine that can launch from anywhere in the world.
Yeah, that's the nuclear triad that Trump didn't know about in the debate, but then just sort of BS'd his way through it, and then that's sort of his, like, unique skill, that he can just sort of talk confidently without knowing anything at all. So that's
right.
How he got elected, pretty much.
There's also a bill that was floated, S-2016, by Ed Markey from Massachusetts that was, like, I mean, I was not particularly impressed by this legislation because I thought it was extremely weak and just sort of implicitly included so many problematic elements. It's called the No Unconstitutional Strike Against North Korea Act of 2017, which, first of all, right off the bat, is emphasizing that there's a different policy for North Korea than for anywhere else, which I think is a weird distinction to make, although it's partly because North Korea has nuclear weapons, which seems to have been a fact that has eluded many of the policymakers right now. They're still acting like North Korea does not have them yet. The other thing is the emphasis on, like, unconstitutionality, and basically saying that it would prohibit a first strike on North Korea without congressional authorization. So leaving open the door to some sort of retaliatory strike, and also leaving the door open to North Korea, I mean, a first strike being authorized by Congress for North Korea. And sort of the basis of that was, like, I mean, he cites a bunch of old stuff from, like, Alexander Hamilton and George Washington and stuff like that about military policy and the balance of power. But, like, I mean, it's hard to take this bill seriously when it says that, well, we'll still keep the power, we'll still keep it so that you could do a war powers authorization, not a declaration of war, and the Congress could quickly authorize a first strike. And also the only way that we're going to prohibit this first strike is by saying that you can't use any appropriations from Congress to launch a first strike. I mean, that doesn't actually stop them. Like, they have the money already. The money has already been spent on the nuclear forces and the, you know, the personnel that turn the keys and that sort of thing. Like, the idea that that you're just going to say, oh, we're going to defund you if you launch a nuclear first strike. I mean, no one's going to care. If they decide to launch it, they decide to launch it. So I just didn't really take that bill that seriously, but it's obviously worth mentioning since it was coming up a lot in the context of these hearings on the nuclear policy review. Now, getting back to this issue that Risch highlights of legitimate disputes when it comes to the power of the president and the power of Congress, this starts to get us to a bigger picture issue here, which is the issue of who actually gets to decide when we get to use nuclear weapons, if at all, in the United States. Now, there was an op-ed in The Hill by the Arms Control Association that said Congress should explore practical options such as requiring that a decision to use nuclear weapons be made by more than one person. This could include the president, vice president, secretaries of state and defense, and perhaps one or more designated members of Congress, such as Speaker of the House or Senate Majority Leader. Eliminating the requirement to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles under attack, which would increase the time available to consider the possible use of nuclear weapons in retaliation to a nuclear attack against the United States or its allies. The second bullet point there referring basically to the issue of, like, if they've got the missiles in the air already, supposedly, do we launch immediately or do we wait for them to actually hit? And that has to do with that concern has to do with the fact that there have been several false alarms during the Cold War, where people thought that the nukes were in the air and that there was an imminent attack underway and that we needed to launch immediately. And in whether it was the U.S. or the USSR, somebody lower down on the chain said, I think this is a false alarm and we're not going to launch. And again, to jump back to what I said earlier, there is plenty of evidence that you don't actually have to launch before they've already, like, before it's actually hit, because you could still launch later. Now, obviously, that's not great, but, like, you might as well be sure that they launched rather than just launching yourself accidentally because you thought that there was something on the radar or whatever.
There was actually a Soviet submarine crew member who, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, basically averted a full-scale nuclear war that would have, you know, been completely devastating because they thought that the U.S. were dropping depth charges on them, but they were only, like, fake depth charges, and they very nearly voted to launch. So, yeah, Vasily Arkhipov. There were a number of other incidents like this as well, including some faulty sort of imaging technologies. Like, geese were thought to be missiles coming at various silos. So,
and there was one incident, I think, involving, like, the angle of reflection of the sun off the clouds or something like that, or maybe some condensation issues and, you know, it gave a false radar signature. Stuff like that happens. So, again, the proposal here from the Arms Control Association is basically saying that because it's you're required to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles while you're under attack, and saying that doesn't need to be. But I want to focus specifically on the issue of who actually gets to launch, which is the issue of the hearing and the issue of that proposal that was talking about, like, the president and the vice president and the House Speaker and that sort of thing. So the congressional perspective, which they don't really enforce, is, like, that they could essentially set the boundaries of the launch authority and, like, put certain conditions on it, that kind of thing, or change the chain of command in terms of, like, right now it's basically just the president alone can decide to do it, which is not true of other sort of military sort of true of some military operations, but, like, this is the one where you have the power to end the world and it's resting in one person's hand. And I think that's bad under anybody. I mean, there was one person who was like, I don't think we should change these policies because of one insane president, because what if we have another good president next time? And it's like, yeah, but I mean, do you really want any president to have that authority? Probably not. But the bigger sort of constitutional problem here is that technically the Constitution says that the president is the commander in chief. And this line in the Constitution, combined with the sort of four-term FDR and then into Truman for fourth and fifth term, plus the advent of nuclear weapons, all sort of consolidating at the end of World War II, has led to a situation where the president has basically a permanent war footing at all times, even when you're not during an active war, which that doesn't happen anymore these days anyway. But you're not during an active war. The president still has this sort of all this power accrued to him and this command authority for launching nuclear weapons. And that leads to buildup of, you know, huge executive power in general, and Congress essentially delegating a lot of its authority in terms of declarations of war and things like that over to the presidency. And it is a really serious issue, right? That the Constitution was written with that part of the Constitution was written in 1787, designating the president one person as the commander in chief. And so the president's position consistently is that intercontinental nuclear ballistic missiles, nuclear armed submarines, and nuclear armed bombers also fall under that category, and that Congress should have no authority over this. So again, Congress is sort of weakly asserting that they hypothetically have authority to like constrain and regulate launch authority, but they don't really use it that much. And the president has consistently, the office of the president, saying, no, not really. Like, I can do whatever I want because I'm the commander in chief. This is not a technology, obviously, that was anticipated by the people writing the Constitution. They were thinking of non-standing armies, local militias, basically.
Hessians.
Right. So, yeah, Hessian mercenaries. So, something that I've been thinking about all year is that the combo of having nuclear weapons in a one-person launch authority plus this commander-in-chief line in the Constitution might be sort of the single biggest, most broken thing about the Constitution that creates these other problems. Now, if you can actually resolve it with congressional legislation that would sort of disperse that launch authority to multiple people, and this proposal here is mentioning like cabinet officials and stuff, but I think also I would want to see like the House Speaker have that authority. I mean, there have been some bad House Speakers, but I think that it's important to disperse it to multiple branches as well and just get more input on it. That if you can change that, then maybe there's some room for discussion here. But like fundamentally, in my view, the Nuclear Launch Authority Commander-in-Chief role in the Constitution is what creates a lot of other ripple effect problems. You could effectively, without even doing much revision to the Constitution, or potentially not even, depending on how far you wanted to go, if it were not for the commander-in-chief line and the fact that we have this nuclear arsenal, you could have already made the de facto leader of the country the House Speaker a long time ago, because you could just, you know, change the presidency into a figurehead, you know, make it so that they have to, like that, you know, because the Senate has to confirm members of the cabinet. You could make it so that the Senate only confirms the people that Congress wants. You know, the president is officially nominating them, but maybe that, you know, Congress can just reject them if it's not their own picks. Like, there are any number of things that you can do under the current structure or with a very minor revision that would basically make it so that the president was more of a figurehead, head of state, leader, you know, kind of like doing the official ceremonies and things like that, and signing legislation and ensuring that the executive branch is functioning, that sort of thing, a more managerial figurehead role. But that can't be done while the president has nuclear launch authority and basically unilateral control over foreign policy in general. Because then your presidential elections would rapidly turn into a situation where there were no domestic policy issues on the table, and it was all about like what level of aggression you were going to take in foreign policy, and everyone would just one-up each other and it would rapidly devolve from there. But on the other hand, that is already what happens essentially, and there's not been a very serious, like, even including Jimmy Carter, there has not been a non-militant president in quite some time. Maybe you could make a case for Gerald Ford, but he wasn't actually elected. Many of these presidents just kind of continually escalate and escalate and escalate the power that they accrue to the presidency, etc. But this is something that I've been thinking about, is this issue that you know, in other countries, they've transitioned away from presidentialism, which is a fundamentally broken model, whether it's here, whether it's in France, whether it's in the former Soviet republics, whether it's across Africa. Presidentialism is a failed model, and having a more prime minister type role is probably more effective for representative democracy in general. But the way that we structured it with our broken 1780s constitution and the creation of a nuclear arsenal is that one man has the unlimited power to obliterate the other side of the planet in 30 minutes or whatever. that was not something that was intended by that constitutional provision, but nobody seems to really be doing anything about it. And it prevents us from transitioning gradually toward a model that does not concentrate all of the power into the presidency and could put a lot more power onto Congress to actually lead the country. I think the other thing you would want to do ideally would probably change term lengths to 4 years for the House instead of two, or potentially even 5 years, depending on how you did it. But regardless, the model that we have right now is completely breaking down. And I think Trump is really highlighting it, but it's an existing thing that's been around there for decades. I wanted to get your thoughts on this issue of the Nuclear Launch Authority and sort of these broader constitutional implications. Rachel, I guess I'll start with you. Your thoughts on this?
So I think you're absolutely correct. We've seen this kind of consolidation of power into the executive branch for the last at least 40, 50 years. And I think we definitely do need to have, I guess, like a come to Jesus moment and really ponder where we want our country to go. And I think having this person with so much consolidated power, you're completely right. We should move to more of a representative, parliamentary, prime ministerial sort of system.
Nate?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it does seem like once you have someone like Trump in there, it sort of calls into question the whole idea of we should be letting one person decide the potential fire and fury devastation, as Trump put it. One other thing I sort of wanted to sort of game out and think about is what actually does happen if, say, we use some sort of tactical nuclear weapon on a battlefield somewhere, whether it's Middle East, whether it's North Korea. It seems like, yeah, there has been some push in order to sort of normalize these types of strikes, not nuclear yet, but there was the mother of all bombs, whether it's the strikes on Syria, and, you know, what then happens if that does, because I think the media will be pushing out generals to explain why this is totally normal and okay and not a big deal.
And actually, yeah,
massive resistance against that in the streets.
Part of that nuclear posture review that I mentioned earlier is not just arguing for like upgrading and expanding the nuclear arsenal, but specifically getting these smaller scale nuclear weapons that could be used in a battlefield context as opposed to, you know, obliterating a city.
Yeah, I think actually Daniel Ellsberg has a recent book out called The Doomsday Machine: Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And I think that could be potentially interesting because there used to be a large anti-nuclear protest movement in this country, and that essentially doesn't exist anymore, you know, in the 50s through maybe the 80s. But
kind of went out with the Cold War,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, and now we're looking at a potential scenario where nuclear weapons could very well be used at some point, and we need to figure out what happens if that does happen and what our response to it is going to be. So.
Yeah, and we can't just talk about this when there's a quote-unquote bad president, because I feel like we did discuss this kind of in the beginning, in its nascent stages during Bush 2, but we have, and then we just kind of completely dropped it when Obama was president. So we have to continue this discussion even when there's a quote-unquote good president, and just not when there's an unpopular, unintelligent president
who says inflammatory things and has holes in his brain.
Yep.
I think the thing that's really concerning is that there was this committee hearing finally for the first time, you know, since the early 70s, and their sort of conclusion was nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, it was this sort of back and forth, yep, there are disputes over who has the power to regulate this, and like there wasn't any sign of an actual coalescing like opinion on what to do about it. Like, no one, like, I read out the op-ed bullet points from the Arms Control Association. That's like one proposal, but it wasn't like that's the proposal that everyone was leaning toward or anything like that. Even some of these Republicans are willing to go on the record and publicly state that they think the president is saying crazy things that are potentially going to get us all killed in a nuclear holocaust, and they're still not willing to actually like put together a bill with a proposal of how to change this. And I'm sure the other thing is, like, as great as some of these elements in the Arms Control Association proposal are, I'm sure that the president's lawyers would tell him to, like, block any sort of legislation like this, or, as with some of the war power stuff in the past,
just ignore them.
Yeah, you just ignore it and say, well, I'm the commander-in-chief and Congress has no authority whatsoever to regulate my use of anything, so it just, this law doesn't exist.
When the president does it, that means it's not illegal, to quote Nixon.
I think it would be a good start to say, like, the president the Secretary of Defense, the House Speaker have to all agree to launch or something like that. But even if this got passed, I don't think it would happen.
Yeah, well, and they're still on a lot of the hair trigger systems, I believe, where it's only like, what, 5 minutes, something like 10 minutes
right.
to
well,
launch.
And part of that has to do with that issue, that requirement to launch when under attack. And that was also their proposal. And I think that's an element, too, where they would just be like, no, we don't agree that Congress has the ability to regulate that, so we're just not going to accept that that's a law. All of this is extremely disturbing. Like, we're at a point where we've got one of the worst possible people to occupy this office, and he's very transparently unfit to hold it in terms of, like, mental faculties and good judgment, and he's just angry, cantankerous, and impulsive all the time, and that's not an act, and they still can't agree on even that we should definitively be doing something, let alone what the actual details of that are. But again, this, I think, does go beyond the actual nuclear weapons themselves and speaks to this broader issue of presidential power and authority, which is why I wanted to bring it up, because I've been thinking about it kind of all year. I know some folks have seen me tweeting about it periodically, that we have this one line in the Constitution thrown in there in the 1780s that creates this ripple effect of all these huge problems because they didn't anticipate having the ability to end the world almost instantly with the power vested in the commander-in-chief. And it's not like, and like, as much as I was complaining about what elections might be like if it was just a foreign policy and military policy election and how bad that could be, it's almost worse that there's no discussion at all. That there, like, that is not something that comes up in these elections. As you said, it comes up minimally when Trump is like BSing his way through not knowing what the 3-point elements of the nuclear policy and strategy are for the United States. But it is also bad that it really doesn't come up that much, and we're not. It actually came up in the UK election.
I was actually just about thinking of that, yeah, where there was that strange questioning, and I think there was one woman, like a millennial woman, who basically said, I put the point to Corbyn, I think it's strange that like you're the only one who doesn't want to blow everything up here. So as if there's that expectation, it's like, oh, yeah, we may have to just eliminate some countries from the map with our, you know, the tridents or whatever, so...
Right. And Jeremy Corbyn getting a round of criticism for saying, I would not authorize a nuclear first strike. That's absurd. And the media trying to say, oh, look at this. He was not willing to do the necessary thing.
He's a Hezbollah supporter.
And the general public was like, no, I mean, we're pretty good in terms of saying, no, we don't want there to be a world ending nuclear annihilation that might or might not be launched accidentally as a first strike that's not in retaliation. I mean, that's like the actual public, when you get down to it, thinks that this is crazy. But the people in power and making all the decisions don't seem bothered by any of this. And again, I think that we need to think very seriously about the implications of the nuclear authority being vested in one person for the broader Constitution and sort of the inability of Congress to be the primary pole in our government as was intended in the Constitution. They were supposed to have primacy, essentially, if any of them did. Anyway, so I just want people to start thinking about that. But Rachel, thank you so much for being here this week.
It's always a pleasure, Bill.
And Nate, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.